Our next case is United States against Dokich. Hester, just hold on. We'll wait till the transition here is complete. Ms. Kister.
Good morning again. As this court is well aware, I'm sure, it was the court that asked the parties to brief a very narrow issue concerning restitution in this case. And I think the question presented is not so much whether the restitution order in this case exceeded the amount of loss, but whether it exceeded the amount of actual damages. And the problem is the court never makes a finding of actual damages in this case.
Well, Ms. Kister, what's your estimate of actual loss?
Well, it's pretty big, Your Honor. And I think the extent to which we're... I think that the government did a credible job and a competent job in showing
not
at least $55 million.
For the prosecutor's estimate. I'm asking for your estimate.
Of actual damages?
Yes, actual loss.
Somewhere in the neighborhood of $55 million. I think they have shown, the government has shown, that investors actually paid that sum of money to buy shares in this company.
Right. I was going to ask you that. I mean, do you think the loss is the price that the investors paid for the shares, which eventually, I assume, become worthless, or is the loss to be measured by some other metric?
Well, if we're talking about actual loss for restitution purposes, I think it's the out-of-pocket funds, the money that these investors paid to buy shares.
Is there a showing that there was never any, there were never any dividends or never any benefits that came along with the shares?
I believe not. Now, some of the earlier investors were paid back. It is a Ponzi scheme.
Right.
So some people are recovering what they paid out. Others have lost their out-of-pocket funds. I believe that the outstanding shares that were not paid back at the end of the scheme were about $55 million.
Those are the ones in this great big submission that the district court receives?
Yes. Yeah, the bulk of the submission. I think the problem comes in later with the final submission by the government that takes it from the $55 million mark to the $55,900,000 mark for these revenue royalty rights. Because I don't know, in looking at the record, that those constitute actual out-of-pocket monies paid by these investors, or whether those were intended losses by the defendants, mm-hmm. in which case they should not be part of this restitution order.
And, of course, the other problem in this case, which is not your problem, it's the government's problem and they've decided not to do anything about it, is that the district court was certainly doing strange things with the sentencing guidelines calculation, using the wrong manual and not bothering to figure out the higher of intended or actual loss and so
Correct.
On, which gets everybody off on the wrong track, I fear.
All we have is a range, that the losses for sentencing purposes fall somewhere within the $20 to $50 million
range. And
it's
almost certainly the wrong range, because if the court had used the 2007 manual and had also used the same figures for actual loss that underlie the restitution figure, the range would have been 121 to 151 months. It would have been
yes.
much higher than
yes.
the range the judge was working with. And if the judge had only done that and then said, well, I think a reasonable sentence is, in fact, you know, the lower sentence, under Booker, the court could have done that. But I doubt we would be here if the court had gone through those calculations properly.
Yes, Your Honor. Mm-hmm.
So you're going to focus right now, though, for our purposes on these revenue royalty, whatever these
My understanding
were.
Of the, excuse me, I came into the case at the appellate level, so I'm not abundantly familiar with all the submissions by the government. My understanding from the record is that they were able to show that most of that, or approximately $55 million, were out-of-pocket losses. And that's fair game in a restitution order. Those are victims that should be paid back mm-hmm. by an order of restitution. I'm troubled by the revenue royalty rights. I think that might be promised profit, promised a stream of revenue, and not an actual loss to the people who bought those rights.
Okay.
Ms. Kister, what's your best estimate of how much your client will be able to pay in restitution over the remaining life of the universe?
Your Honor, my client calls me weekly and is sure he's coming home soon, although he is in his 60s. So the short answer would be virtually none, regardless of what this order of restitution
it's
reflects.
It's hard to see the point of a dispute between, say, $35 million and $55 million of a client being represented at public expense under the Criminal Justice Act.
Yes, Your Honor, and I think the margin is even narrower than that.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And we do know that you filed an Anders brief at first, so
right.
we're not laying all of this at your
right.
feet.
Right. You've been conscripted.
Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Stern.
May it please the Court.
I'm sure you don't want to be here either, but here we are in this completely useless exercise. Since the probability of Mr. Dokich paying even $1 million is negligible. How
yes.
do we get to $57 million? Let me tell you my problem. Your brief says it's the, quote, total value of all shares of stock. And you say that's what the pre-sentence report said, which I find incoherent. If that's the value of all the shares, then it's not loss, right? Loss is the difference between what was paid and the value of the security on the day of the payment. Was there any effort to determine that difference for any investor?
Judge, the way that the loss was calculated was the amount that the investors actually paid and how much they got back. So that...
That's certainly not what your brief says.
If the brief doesn't say that, then I've stated it incorrectly.
But that would be, you know, if somebody bought a share of... I don't know, you know, General Motors at a high price, and then they tried to sell it the day after General Motors declared bankruptcy earlier this year, they would have suffered quite a loss. But as far as I know, I mean, let's just assume that this is just one of those vicissitudes of the market that would happen. So I think what maybe Judge Easterbrook is asking is, as of the day somebody bought a share in Efura, was there any positive value? If they decided, oh, actually I don't want Efura the next week, could they have gone off and sold it?
Well, the problem was that all of the sales and purchases were based on false information. So that to the extent...
Of course they were, but the question that Judge Wood asked, the question I asked, is what was the value of the asset on the day of the sale? Right? Suppose you buy a sheep that's worth $100, but because of fraud, you pay $200 for the sheep. What's the loss? Is it $100 or $200? You know, the normal answer is your loss is $100 because you got this sheep worth $100, and that's the same for securities. So what do we know about the value of the securities on the day of the transactions?
Judge, the value, because it was created by Efura, was whatever Efura said the value was. And, in fact, that
no,
changed.
That's not the value.
Private company? Because there are ways that private company shares are...
Right. This was never publicly sold. It was always a private transaction. And, basically, David Brodsky...
But that happens all the time. There are divorces. There are sellouts. I mean, people do have ways of...
There are buy-sell agreements. There are appraisals. You know, as this is described, Efura was a real company at some point before the fraud began. It presumably had assets, some kind of business, maybe not a very successful one.
And we began the loss in 1999 at the date that the fraud began. We did not begin it in 1996 when the company actually began. So we excluded anything before we had firm proof that they were making false representations. My understanding of loss for guidelines purposes is that it's on the day or at the time that the fraud is discovered. So that at the time the fraud was discovered.
No, that can't possibly be right. Take my sheep example. The sheep is worth $100. As a result of fraud, you pay $200 for the sheep. You keep the sheep for 2 years, and it dies of natural causes. The fraud is then discovered. What's the loss, $100 or $200? No, it's still $100.
In that case, in this case, though, I'm not sure of the answer to your sheep example, but here there was no real market value for the shares because they were simply, Afora was simply making up the value of the shares, and a large part of it was the promise that this company was about to go public and it was about to get FDA approval of its products.
Let me ask the question a different way. Does the record show during this period of time you're focusing on, 1999 to 2006, whether Afora was engaged in any productive activities at all?
Judge, it does. The answer is that the company was selling some products overseas. But, and the reason that the record shows it is because the amount of revenue that it had was very, very small. It had losses. It couldn't support its own activities. And the way that it supported its activities was through the sale of more stock. That's basically why they had to keep selling the stock. So it had very, very small revenues, and even those revenues trickled out because they were having problems with the test itself. It was not satisfactory. It couldn't show whether there was a positive or a negative result.
Not a particularly good question.
I've got a related question, which is, why was this case prosecuted as mail fraud? This is a dead bang securities fraud case. These securities had to be registered and sold under Section 5 of the Securities Act of 1933, and they weren't. But why did you prosecute a perfectly simple securities fraud case as mail fraud and money laundering?
The money laundering specifically was the Dokich's deposit of money and withdrawal of under $10,000 of money. That one was an easy one. In terms of the mail fraud, it's very simple to explain to a jury. We certainly could have charged it as the securities. My gut instinct is that the securities...
My bet is that after this term of the Supreme Court, you'll be filing fewer mail fraud prosecutions. Maybe you should just count yourself as lucky that this one got to where it is. But one reason why I ask this is because we would know to a certainty what the restitution award would be if this had been prosecuted as securities fraud. Section 11 and Section 12(2) couldn't be clearer. The remedy for a securities fraud violation is rescission. In other words, the investors get back every penny they paid, right? And they have to tender back the securities. Absolutely simple. All of these complications in figuring out restitution have been introduced by not prosecuting a securities fraud as a securities fraud.
Very good point, Judge, and I wish we had done it that way. I agree with you. It would have been nice to have avoided it. The question I think that was posed, and the reason that we have the appeal, is whether or not the actual loss and the amount of restitution match. And I think that the problem arose, as you correctly pointed out, because of the guideline issue. And, of course, the reason that the guideline issue hasn't been raised by the defense is because it was basically a benefit to the defendant that he started at a lower guideline range. It arose because we originally, looking at this, knew that there was a loss of at least $35 million based on the documents that we had and the review that we'd done at the time of the plea agreement and the non-plea agreement, the blind plea entered by Mr. Dokich. It became clear after the agents went through the very many records that they reviewed that the actual loss was $55 million. And that's what the government said throughout its filings. Once the analysis had been done by the agent, the government in its statement said that the actual loss to the investors and the restitution amount was the $55 million. In terms of the royalty, the revenue royalty, again, it was the same false representations. Investors turned over their money based on the false representations, and then they lost all their money based on the false representations. So that at the time of the sentencing, $55 million, $55.9 million was the loss that the government had calculated.
I guess I can't figure out then why you didn't assert that as the amount of loss relative to the offense level.
Judge, we should have. The fact of the matter was that when the plea negotiations were going on, when the plea was entered by Mr. Grosky and Mr. Rappin and the blind plea by Mr. Dokich, we thought that the numbers were lower, that it was $35 million. The government thought that it was crucial to get the appropriate amount of restitution for the victims, which was the $55 million. But in terms of the guidelines, the government should have argued that it was a higher guideline. It didn't actually matter because the judge ended up going below for each of the sentences, 24 months below the guideline range that he found, and for Mr. Dokich, and 48 months below for Mr. Grosky.
But of course, I don't know whether this is a legal fiction or whether there's reality, but we do say that the judge needs to start from the correctly calculated guidelines range, and if the judge had thought it was 121 to 151, I don't really know whether he would have picked 84 months out of the air or whether he might have thought 100 months or something else. And so there's still a problem, I think, relating to what Judge Tinder's talking about.
I believe Judge Shader went through and specifically said he thought the guidelines as they stood were so high that to impose them would make people disregard the law, that they would feel that the law was too oppressive to apply the guidelines that he found, and therefore could not be that high, so that it's unlikely that he could have believed that or would have imposed a higher sentence. The government would respectfully request that you affirm the restitution amount. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Stern. Anything further, Ms. Kister?
No, Your Honor.
Well, thank you very much. And again, we thank you for undertaking the appointment here. The case is taken under advisement.